As much as I trash, nitpick, and criticize the music business, I still hold on very dearly to the reasons that attracted me to this seedy line of work in the first place. The music, the chance to perform the music, the applause, and every now and then the interesting people you are lucky enough to meet in this nomadic, blood-sucking, rigged game called rock and roll. When you think about it, the time you are given to actually bask in the glory and revel in the tradition of rock and roll and feel the volume and vibration of the loud music that brought us all together in the first place is usually as fleeting as 80 minutes, 60 minutes, half an hour, sometimes as short as 15 to 20 minutes, depending on how long your set is. And you quickly realize that the business of rock and roll is largely spent killing downtime, thus the lopsided drug and alcohol casualties that have played a large part in both defacing and mythologizing its image. These days, with laptops and iPads, it's easy for a band to pass the time and avoid fatal temptations, but no matter how much streaming you do or trolling you embark on, nothing comes close to meeting a kindred spirit out on the road and hearing the stories that only a precious few can tell. Despite the rock and roll game being overrun by bloated egos, weak posturing, and inflated machismo, it only takes a few minutes to spot these gracious individuals too. They're humble but confident, energetic but exude calmness, and their stories, man, they got a ton, and you want to hear all of them. This summer, while we were out on the road on the Uproar Festival, we got to play with a lot of bands, one of them being the Walking Papers. The Walking Papers are a band from Seattle, Washington, featuring none other than Duff McKagan, bassist for Guns N' Roses and Velvet Revolver, and Loaded, who we toured with earlier this year, but more importantly, a past guest on this podcast. In fact, knowing Duff was going to be on the tour put us all at ease. At least we'd know one cool person there. Now, if you've listened to this podcast before, you might be getting an inkling that I'm somewhat of a shut-in, or a near mute, if you will. Not too social outside of our band and crew. I like to keep to myself. It takes a while to get me to come out of my shell, and partly why I do this podcast in the first place. It's to stem all that. Very rarely do I meet someone where I immediately hit it off, but Barrett Martin, drummer of the Walking Papers, is such a person. Just about every time we'd see each other on the tour, our discussions lasted hours, and after a few of them, I realized that our talks were being lost into the ether, so it was only natural that I ask him to be on the podcast, to which he kindly agreed. Aside from drumming for the Walking Papers, Barrett's CV reads like a wish list of bands, from Skinyard, Screaming Trees, and Mad Season, to collaborations with Peter Buck in Tuatara, Cedell Davis, Queens of the Stone Age, Twilight Singers, Stone Temple Pilots, and Tad, to name a few. As you will hear on this episode, talk with Barrett can go from one extreme to the next without so much as batting an eye. In fact, there's one story at the end where he pretty much blew my mind and was quite unprepared for his story. So talk continued longer than planned, and I had to cut it down with a promise of part two. So part two with Barrett Martin will be coming up in the next few weeks. There's a point in this podcast where talk turns to Steve Martin, and although it might sound odd to mention it here now, I just wanted to make it clear that Steve Martin wrote his autobiography Born Standing Up in 2007, and the other Steve Martin book I refer to in this episode is called Pure Drivel from 1998. Doesn't make sense now, but it will once you hear it. I just wasn't able to remember the names of the books while we were taping. Like every episode, this podcast is most thankful to Blue Mic Microphones for their Yeti mics and to Skullcandy headphones. Both support the podcast, and I'm very, very thankful for that. Okay, here we go. Here's Barrett Martin, and he is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now.
Should we start our conversation by saying that we have these great conversations in catering, wishing that we had the microphones turned on?
I'm very nervous about this because
We joked about it yesterday, but we might freeze recording this conversation just because we're supposed to be on.
Right. And there's something to be said about the cacophony of a catering area, and there's people around, and you just free form conversation. And
but I've gone after our discussions, I've come back on the bus and just said, I just spent 3 hours with Barrett talking. Yeah. What were you guys talking about for like 2.5 hours?
Yeah.
You know, everything, and I can't remember anything. But yeah, there's just been some great stories lobbed over during our talks that I had to get you on the podcast.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. And what you need to do is go to one of those spy shops and buy one of those little hidden remote recording devices, and then you'll get some great stuff.
We had a 90-minute talk about art.
Yeah.
And for you to procure a discussion about art from me, now that takes some doing, and you did it. We talked about it for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah. And
it was the length of a standard college lecture.
And when it was done, I was just like, well, there's a podcast down the tubes that we'll never hear, an episode. So,
but these are not that we have to have another discussion about art history, but I mean, I've always felt that art, music, literature, film, these are the most important things that humanity can offer, because so much information and social messages and, you know, deep commentary is contained in those mediums. And I've just always loved that stuff.
Now, I guess it'll be said in the intro and everything, but you are playing drums with your band, The Walking Papers. We're on tour together here for the Uproar Festival.
Yep.
But over and above that, I didn't know until yesterday you told me that you do art as well.
Yeah.
And the way you do it was more interesting than most. There's a process or a way, a certain way that you do your pieces.
Well, what happened, I'd always, as I said, you know, I'd always loved art and, you know, studied it in college. And when I have days off, if I'm anywhere near a museum, or particularly a modern art museum, I'll go because I want to see what people are doing. But for me, getting into doing art, I had been studying Zen meditation and Zen philosophy. And after a few years of doing that, I took a class in Zen painting. And you've probably seen examples of it in books or where they use the charcoal ink and it's black and gray.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And, you know, it actually started as an ancient Taoist tradition in China, and then the Zenists in Japan adopted it, and it became a very stylized form. In particular, the painting of circles, the Enzo, is a meditation in itself. And so I took some classes in that, and how to make the ink and how to, you know, brush stroke techniques and things like that. And then at a certain point, I just started using acrylics and, you know, multicolored acrylics, and kind of developed my own style, which is kind of influenced by people like Jackson Pollock and Claude Monet, of the, you know, kind of abstract impressionists. But then also with this concept of meditating and then doing the painting quickly.
Right. That's, you were saying that.
Which, that's the process. You meditate for half an hour to 45 minutes, sometimes upwards of an hour, and then you do the painting very quickly.
5 minutes?
Sometimes, well, if you're just doing circle painting, you might do that in a few seconds.
Right.
And the idea of the painting is that if you do an Enzo, a circle painting, you're showing movement of the spirit within the brush. And there's a lot of symbolic meaning in the circle itself. It represents life, the circle of life. The void in the center is the emptiness from which the universe comes from. This is, you know, Buddhist philosophy as well. So that would be a whole other conversation there. But if you understand the symbolism of it, then the painting makes sense. It's kind of like you need to kind of understand the theory that of where it's coming from, and then. But at the same time, it's kind of like what we were talking about yesterday. You can see a piece of art and not necessarily know the history behind it, but it can move you. You can feel affected by it.
And I was saying that very rarely, if ever, has that ever happened to me, unlike music, where you can just be dropped in on any era, any time, and you can connect with it on a spiritual, on a gut level. And I just, I've never felt that kind of visual connection in art the way I have with music.
Well, I think I feel it in music as much, if not more so, than in art, being primarily a musician.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those people that I think of music as a mystical and spiritual process. Of course, you know, there's socio-political commentary to be made, but at its core foundation, music is a rhythmic, melodic, vibrational art form. It's abstract because we can't see it.
Yes.
Unless it's written out or, yeah, you know, the medium of a CD or a piece of vinyl. But the universe is a vibrational place. It's constantly vibrating. And modern physics is proving this, but I think we as musicians kind of feel that automatically.
You told me as well yesterday that I brought up Ravi Shankar, and then yeah, you brought up the fact that you opened for him with another band.
Yeah, this was about 15 years ago, 96, 97, I think. I have this instrumental band called Tuatara, which I started with Peter Buck from REM. And we started doing it to do film soundtrack work because we wanted to do instrumental kind of soundscape stuff without having to think of pop songs. And
right,
so we made a couple albums for Sony, and they did fairly well. You know, we toured and we actually did do some film soundtrack work. And
which films?
I did a film called Lush, which starred Laura Linney and Campbell Scott. It's basically about a couple alcoholics in New Orleans, but you know, it was an art house film. You know,
right,
these are not like major motion pictures.
I've seen the video box in the video store.
Yeah, it's kind of a jazz soundtrack for that particular one. And then we've had songs in TV shows. We had a song in Sex and the City, and you know, just like, you know, cues basically. But it got us into making albums, and we're working on a new album right now. But back in 97, Peter Gabriel asked us to play this WOMAD festival.
Right.
And we were on the main stage and got
That's
to open
awesome.
For Ravi Shankar.
That's
and
amazing.
So I watched the master from the side of the stage.
And how was he when you met him?
It was just a formal, you know, shake hands and, right, you know, kind of a meet and greet kind of thing. But
yeah,
he was very gracious. He did radiate an energy of calmness and serenity and very, very dignified, elegant man. And it was right around that time his daughter Anushka was playing with him, and she's kind of the heir apparent of that legacy.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
so they played as a duo, and they had a tabla player and I think one other and a harmonium player, I think. But when you watch a great master like that play and you're in their physical presence, it changes how you think about music. And I think in that same conversation
I brought that.
Yeah.
The fact that you are loaded with all this pre-information about this person, but that plays a part in how you view them and how you're affected by them.
Right.
You know, when you're in their presence.
Right.
I mean, I've been in the presence of people that were very famous, and you walk away going, man, I could feel his energy. It was right there. But maybe it's because I've been seeing two-dimensional pictures of him for like my whole life or something.
Right. Yeah, your mind is loaded up with all these photographs and these internal stories that your mind has created, which, you know, as we know, being in rock and roll, all that stuff gets overblown and mythologized.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I was there when that happened, and that's not what happened.
You know? Yeah, for sure. But I would think, you know, someone like Ravi Shankar, and you can argue that, you know, classical East Indian music is a little more spiritual than, you know, the average 4/4 rock song that we all engage in. I think maybe that lends itself to some sort of extra layer of aura.
You know? Well, you know, you have to even take into account the fact that, you know, something like classic, you know, Hindustani Indian music is built to, you know, where the ragas come from.
The times
of the day that they should be played.
Yeah.
The scales are different going up than they are coming down. and they sometimes correspond with spiritual or emotional parts of the body. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the tals, the rhythms, mm-hmm. The way that they affect consciousness, the speed and the tempo of the tals. I mean, these are deep spiritual classical forms of music that go back, in some cases, thousands of years.
Well, from classical East Indian music, I take with the contemporary music I listen to, when it comes to the times of the day that you listen to certain ragas, I apply that to my music listening with my bands that I listen to and I like. You know, like the only time I can listen to reggae music is in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, the only time I can listen to like dark, hard, eerie, almost ambient music is at night.
Yeah.
You know, that applies as well.
You know, speaking of reggae, I'm not real knowledgeable about it, but I'm one of those people that absolutely loves Bob Marley. And the reason why I do is because he was a great songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I love his songs. Mm-hmm. And I understand a little bit about how, you know, where the reggae... This is an interesting thing. Did you know that back when reggae was first emerging, there was a radio station that was broadcast. I think it was Radio America was broadcasting, and they had to triangulate and bounce off the atmosphere so that when it would hit the radio stations in Jamaica, it had a pulse to it. Like the way they would receive it had this pulse to it. And at the time, the music that was being played was jazz, you know, bebop jazz and, you know, music that was popular in the 50s and 60s. So when you heard that music over the radio in Jamaica, it had a pulse to it. And that's, the ethnomusicologists say that that's how the feel of reggae began to develop.
Oh, wow.
Is that pulse, they're listening to American jazz, but with this backbeat pulse to it.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
It's
Barrett.
And when I was taught this in school, I was just like, wow, that's amazing how technology and the atmosphere affects how we perceive of music.
Did you take a course on world music?
I have a master's degree in ethnomusicology.
Oh, so you took a variety of courses over a period of years.
yeah. And I taught ethnomusicology and, you know, cultural anthropology in college. I was an adjunct professor for about 3 years.
Oh, so I just took a world music course.
But even one course, it's amazing what you can learn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, or that the steel drum in Trinidad was a direct result of 50-gallon oil drums that had been, they used Trinidad as a garbage dump to dispose of oil drums during World War II. That's where they would leave the empty drums. It was an oil depot as well. And the locals figured out how to make it into an instrument.
And now we have soca.
That's right. Or...
Great.
Right.
But that's an amazing story. I didn't know that either.
And we're on tour with Jane's Addiction, and when they play their finale, Jane says, Stephen Perkins comes out and plays a steel drum, mm-hmm. which is a huge part of that.
So
pop
it's the,
song.
The big circle.
The circle is completed.
Right. So I guess bringing it back to more of a rock and roll thing, you're on tour with Walking Papers, and we were on tour with Loaded earlier this year.
That's
with
right.
Duff.
Yeah.
And... And then once again, Duff is out with us and we're on tour together, but it's with another band. So how did you guys form and meet up? I mean, I have an inkling as to how, but what's the
Walking
official story?
Papers. Walking Papers, I've known Duff for many years, almost 20 years, and we actually had a series of jam sessions in Los Angeles in the mid-1990s before he formed... It was after he left Guns N' Roses, but before he formed Velvet Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great chemistry as a rhythm section, but we were not able to find a guitar player or a singer to do a band. So we just kind of, you know, remained friends, but sort of went... We both went back to school, actually. Duff went back to college, and so did I. And then he formed Velvet Revolver. Sort of flash forward 15 years, and I met Ben and Jeff from the missionary position, which is a kind of a beloved Seattle. They're like the heaviest lounge band in Seattle, basically. And I played a couple shows with them and really, really liked the way that they played music and the way Jeff wrote lyrics. And
he's a great singer.
Yeah.
They're both great singers, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and they'd done a lot of back, you know, Ben had been a backup vocalist for Jeff. So I called Jeff and I said, hey, do you want to do a project? But I wasn't thinking it was really going to be a rock band. I kind of thought it would be more like, let's write some songs and I'll play vibraphone or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Jeff and I got together and wrote the first clump of songs, and I had some studio time booked, and we went in and laid down basic tracks, but we realized, you know, we kind of need a bass player and we need some additional, you know, players on this. So the first person we thought of was Duff, and Duff was very happy to come down and play with me again, and he already knew Jeff, so that kind of made it a trio. And then we brought Ben in to do keyboards and additional backup vocals, and so the band came together making the album.
Now, what year is this?
This is winter of 2011.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Going into 2012. So it was about, you know, a year and a half ago that we made the album.
So this is post-Loaded for Duff.
Yeah.
So he's got Velvet Revolver. He's got Loaded on his plate.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it's after. I mean, he still does Loaded as, you know, that's his solo thing.
Yeah.
But they're kind of on hiatus right now, and we all really... As I said, I didn't know that it was going to become a rock band, but it has, and a good one. And I'm really having a good time with it. I love being able to play, you know, great rock and roll that has a good story, you know, good narrative to the whole thing, and just being able to play with, you know, friends of mine.
Is this your first real tour of America? Have you guys done...
This is our first North American tour. We did a brief West Coast tour last November, which went very well, but it was just a little club tour that we were doing. So this is our first North American tour, and we've been to Europe 3 times now.
We played a show together, but I didn't meet you that day.
I met JC. Yeah, that was in Sweden.
Bravo Love Festival.
That's right.
Yeah. And then I told you I heard the Walking Papers on the radio in Finland.
We played
a few weeks later, in Finland.
And I saw, which that was actually, I think literally, when we played in Finland, I saw 2 Danko Jones videos at a club.
Oh.
And they were great. I actually don't know the names of the songs, but they were really cool videos back to back. And then we saw you play the next day. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, there's, you know, people are going to want to hear about it, and you told me one of the best stories in a long time, but you got to tell me the story that you told me about you hanging out with Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic.
Okay, so
in San Francisco.
Yeah, I was in really my first real rock band that made records and toured. It was a band called Skin Yard, one of the proto grunge bands, and the guitar player was Jack Endino.
And a fan.
And he's a righteous dude, Jack is, and he's produced some amazing records, including Nirvana's Bleach, for Soundgarden Records.
He's coming on this tour for a date.
That's right. Yeah. When we play in Washington State, he's on that with his solo band. So we were in San Francisco. This is about I'm trying to remember if it was late 90 or maybe early 91. But we were in San Francisco a day early, and somehow Jack got a call from, it was either Kurt or Chris Novoselic, and they said, well, we're in San Francisco too. Let's get together. We're going to go to this club called the I-Beam. It's right on Haight-Ashbury. It's not there anymore, but it was a pretty famous club at the time. And we're going to go see this band called Scream. And their drummer is this guy, Dave Grohl, and we're checking him out to see if we might want to have him in Nirvana. So we're just thinking, okay, let's go hang out with our friends and go to the club. And there weren't a lot of people in there. I remember the scene well. I don't think there's more than 50 people, and it's a big club. It's actually probably holds, you know, close to 1,000 people. There's Dave Grohl playing the drums, and he's just destroying the drums. I mean, really playing at a very high level of the game. And And I leaned over to Chris, the bass player, and I said, you better get that guy in your band before somebody else does. And everybody kind of nodded like, yep, that's the guy. So I think shortly after that, he was offered the gig, and they went to make the Nevermind record. So,
and everyone knows what happened after that. Yeah. That's a great story. But what comes full circle about that was, I think you told that to me right after the guy who also on that stage that day was sitting right beside
That's
us.
That's right. The singer for Scream was Pete Stahl.
He's on this tour with us.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get him on one of the podcast episodes because Pete sang on our album, one of our records, a couple of records back.
And I, over the years, had done some recording sessions with Pete with his band, The Earthlings.
Yes.
Which was based in Joshua Tree at the Rancho de la Luna studio, which is where Josh from Queens of the Stone Age does the desert sessions.
Dave Ketching.
And Dave Ketching is the owner, proprietor.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I've played on two or three Earthling songs, and I believe a couple of them made their actual album, but I don't have a copy of it. So,
right.
Yeah.
I realized, I think, after I met Pete for the first time on this tour, that I'm wearing a jean jacket with his band's patch sewed onto it. He hasn't seen that yet, but
he had a band after Scream called Wool.
Yes, my old band played with Wool.
Yeah,
back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And when Pete came down to record the song on our album, I brought that up. I don't know if he was being nice, and we'll find out soon enough. But
he'll have some good stories to tell. You know,
but he goes, "Yeah, I remember you," or something like that. Yeah. I'm like, "There's no way, Pete. It was one show, and maybe we made that big of an impression on him." But I definitely remember playing with Wool.
Yeah,
in Toronto, it was great, and I loved Wool.
Yeah, Pete has a great voice. I mean, it's a unique. You kind of recognize it when you hear
it,
you know.
Yeah, and when he came down in the studio, and he really quiet guy, obviously, and when he started singing, me and the producer of the record, Nick Raskolnik, we looked at each other, and we were just like, fuck.
Yeah.
Because he had done a Goatsnake record, and he had suggested Pete to me. Yeah. And when I heard his name lobbed out there, I was like, fuck it. You know Pete Stahl. So it was nice to do, and we did it at Dave Grohl's studio, 606. So,
in the one in L.A.
Yeah. So it was kind of a nice circle. And then, speaking of Dave Ketching and Josh Homme, John Garcia's on the same track.
Right.
So there's a kind of another circle.
Yeah. I was telling you, you got to get out to the Rancho in Joshua Tree, because that studio is. I mean, a lot of people have made the pilgrimage out there because so many great, you know, people albums have been made at that studio, and it's surprising when you get there, because it's just in this little, you know, ranch house. It's not a huge fancy studio, but it's got a vibe in there, and there's Joshua trees everywhere, and it's beautiful.
Our drummer on this tour, Rich,
his
old band recorded there too, so he knows that studio. He likes that place a lot. And you're not the first person to tell us that we should go there and record and catch the vibe.
Yeah.
But maybe. But it was nice. It's nice to know that, like, Pete is on the tour as well.
Yeah.
It was nice to know that you guys are on the tour.
Yeah.
It was kind of, we were like, all right, well, this is going to be fun, you know, like knowing you guys were there. And of course, I just met you here, but, you know, the fact that Duff is, in a sense, vouching for all of you guys in a way. Like, all right, this should be cool, and it certainly has. So,
and you know, another thing that's kind of special for me is that it was 20 years ago in 1993 that my old band, Screaming Trees, opened for Alice in Chains when their Dirt record came out. And we did it was almost a year, I think it was 8 or 9 month world tour all over Europe, North America, and we went on after that to play other parts of the world. But that was a real powerful year, because it was their breakthrough year with the Dirt album, and our album Sweet Oblivion had come out. And you know, and then 20 years goes by, and you know, we've lost a few people. We lost Lane Staley and other people. But you know, if you're in this business for 20 years or more, you know, you kind of look around and you see who's still standing. And, you know, they usually have some real character that they've developed over the decades. A lot of life experience, a lot of musical experience. You know, people have gone on to do other projects and work with different people. But, you know, I'm in my mid-40s now, so I don't feel old, but I don't feel like I did when I was 24, you know? But I like being this age. I like seeing my peers and seeing how they've done and what they've learned and just that world experience that comes from that.
And they're headlining this whole festival.
Yeah.
So they've actually gained ground.
Yeah. And they sound killer, man. Their live sound, their show is amazing.
Yeah.
You know what one of the best parts of this tour is? The catering.
It really
is. That is good food consistently every day, you know, three times a day. Those people work so hard. I mean, talk about getting up early and having breakfast for a crew of 250 people. Which leads us into another subject. The art of cooking and... Just in case we don't touch on
we have to, because
how did we get into that? What was the
if you're gonna sit and have a discussion with me for over a period of days for more than an hour at a time, we're gonna touch on Three's Company.
That's right,
which is my favorite TV show of all time.
I grew up on it, and through two Mr. Ropers.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, I mean, after like Kiss, it's Three's Company. Like in terms of like pop culture isms that kind of almost mold me and define me.
Yeah.
I was the guy who was on the forums when they were releasing each season every 6 months on DVD.
Yeah.
Checking in when that release date is.
Yeah.
Like I'm one of those dudes. So. Yeah.
It's classic. It's a classic comedy show because. It's always, if you watch the arc of any given show, it always starts with two people having a conversation, a third person overhearing the conversation but totally misinterpreting the meaning, you know, because there's always all, it's loaded with innuendo and and references that if you didn't know the context of it, you would assume something totally different.
Yeah.
So almost every show starts off with this, the triple misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Hilarity ensues. And I believe I make a strong argument that John Ritter, as Jack, the guy that really wants to be a truly great chef. Now, when did that show premiere? I'm going to guess like 76, 77.
As much as of a fanboy I just said I was, I think it was 76.
Yeah, it's a
77.
Late, mid-late 70s. Yes. It's in California, so the food and health craze is just starting to... That's where it started in the United States.
I see, I didn't know that. It's in L.A.
Yeah.
It takes place in L.A.
Yeah, and so I make the argument that... That John Ritter as Jack the chef is the vector for the celebrity chef movement that would happen 25 years later in the United States.
And when you brought that idea up, I didn't argue it. I really feel that show really kind of, I mean, I was just a kid then, but I didn't know that eating was something to be, you know, precious about.
Yeah.
And there's like, there was like a hierarchy of eating, and
it
made me aware for the first time that there's such thing as fine dining and fine restaurants.
Right.
And when I think about it, when a movie scene is set in a fine, like dining restaurant, you know, when the actors are all dolled up and something's about to happen there, I realized after you said that stems from when, you know, Jack would, you know, be on a date or would be out in the kitchen and some crazy shit's happening in the main hall.
Right, right.
That I never knew that, you know, that's really where it stems from, and all this Hell's Kitchen and Food Network and all these people.
Yeah, yeah. The Food Network, I think, it might even be the biggest cable network at this point. It's gigantic.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
but food guys critics, like
Anthony Bourdain, you know, his show is now a CNN travel show. And he started out as a
he's kind of transcended that whole.
Yeah, it's become like a pop icon at this point, you know.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, a good thing about the cooking movement is that prior to that, you know, good food and good eating was kind of rarefied to the elite that had the money to do that kind of thing. Now people learning how to cook in their homes, like really cook. people can have good food, and they have a knowledge of it that they didn't have before.
And it's interesting that that was kind of like the character they wrote for this kind of, like, because obviously it appealed to a demographic of like 18 to 30 year olds, I'm guessing, like,
yeah,
real, a young, yeah, crowd, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that this was the character's makeup, he was a
right
cooking school
right
guy into
right
a chef,
right?
It was just so odd. And then the girls that he lived with
right
couldn't cook. They had no background in cooking,
right?
They
right
they surrendered to him, like,
right,
he was the, he
right
owned the kitchen,
right,
which was a kind of a flipping of roles way back then.
And here's another thing I just thought of. The whole premise, another ongoing theme of that show, was that it was assumed that Jack was gay, which was the only reason why Mr. Roper let him live,
yeah,
with two girls that he wasn't, which he wasn't married to.
Right.
Of course, on the show, he's not gay, but he has to play the part of being gay, which, again, you know, this predates by 25, 30 years.
Even, you know, the discussion of
the, exactly,
yeah,
the gay rights, the ability to, well, now get married,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
to a partner of your choice.
Mm-hmm.
So the archetype of Jack, the supposedly gay chef, I mean, that predates two huge social movements,
yeah,
in the United States.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it can be said that comedy is one of the, I should have listed that in the beginning, as one of the great art forms of a way to pass on information and intelligence and insight. But of course, humor is, I mean, that's such a great medium for that, because people love to laugh. They want to be in on the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then the joke makes them think, like, oh, okay, here's what's going on.
And when you look back on those old episodes, you know, it is dated, just the, but I mean, it's like 30 years old, the way they dealt with, you know, the gay issue.
Right.
You know, when
right
Mr. Roper would like hold up his pinky,
yeah,
and just,
yeah,
go Tinkerbell,
mm-hmm,
and stuff,
right,
and
right,
and just his,
yeah,
viewpoint. I think people today really have this disconnect with how it was. Things move so fast that they forget that, well, you can't expect what happened 30 years ago to fall in line with how we all think today. It was
right
because of those
right
images and those shows that paved the way
right
for how we accept, you know, the,
right,
the gay and lesbian community now, the
yeah
way we do.
And that, I mean, that is, that right there is the argument for liberalism versus conservatism. Literally, from a philosophical standpoint, the conservative philosophy is to not ask questions and to just take the status quo as it is and believe that that is the only way that things can be.
Mm-hmm.
The liberal philosophy is to push forward socially, economically, intellectually, artistically, and try to see, well, what is the next thing? Because it's got to be better than what we're stuck in.
Right.
And so the art forms are the spear point of that. You know,
right,
music is, you know, clearly art and film, but I think, you know, well-written TV shows, good comedies.
Comedy.
Totally.
Yeah, like you said,
yeah,
it breaks down the,
yeah,
laughing breaks down a lot of barriers in a,
yeah,
way. But yeah, totally.
And I think it's important to think of, you know, because we live in this politically polarized world that's either, you're either a liberal or you're a conservative. But instead of thinking of it as a political spectrum, think of it as a philosophy. You know, conservative philosophy gets stuck. It's kind of stuck in the mud. It doesn't think what else is possible. And the liberal philosophy looks at all possibilities and asks questions. And
mm-hmm
it's in the asking of questions that evolution takes place.
How do we take what we just discussed and bring it back to what we were discussing yesterday?
About art history?
Because
we
Dice
know
Clay
how much you love to talk about. Oh, yeah, comedy. That's right. Yeah, we were talking about George Carlin and...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, the great comedians.
I mean,
Louis C.K.
Yeah,
and
this episode is just kind of glossing over hours,
yeah,
of the discussions that we've had over the last kind of couple of weeks on this tour.
You know what? Who we didn't talk about yesterday, but it's important... I mean, I'm old enough that I was growing up when Richard Pryor was the biggest comedian in the world, and also George Carlin and Steve Martin, for that matter. I mean, when I was a kid, Steve Martin was, you know, he was doing stand-up routines and releasing, you know, comedy albums.
Yeah, I wish he still did it.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, Steve Martin's he's a classic Renaissance man. You know, he's a comedian first, and then he became a novelist and an actor, and he's an incredibly good banjo player.
Yeah, I think he's been nominated or won some Grammy.
Yeah, for that last album, and he has one of the largest art collections in the world.
Yeah, he's a super art collector,
and he's knowledgeable about art. Like he can speak fluently about periods of time, and
Have you ever read some of not the more of his comedy books? Have you ever read any of that stuff?
When I was a kid, I had all of them. Yeah.
Oh, like Cruel Shoes and stuff?
I had Cruel Shoes, and Comedy Is Not Pretty.
Comedy's Not Pretty.
Yeah.
But the books that he
put... Cruel Shoes. Oh, man, I'm totally back in high school right now, but okay.
The comedy books he's written in the last maybe they're 10 years old now, 15 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's all we can get in terms of stand-up comedy from Steve Martin now, I'm more than willing to take it because they're fucking hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
So funny. And it's just, it's nice to know that a guy who you know, he's out of the game. No, he's not. He's so on point. Yeah. He's just chosen not to do it in that medium. But I'm more than happy to read his little essays or funny essays that he's written and compiled.
Yeah.
They're still like belly aching hilarious.
Yeah. He strikes me as the kind of guy that has achieved and done. I mean, he's played at the top of the game in all those categories as a comedian, as an actor, as a writer, and as now as a banjo player.
Yeah.
I think he can kind of call his shots and do whatever he wants to do.
There's something about his comedy, though, on his comedy records that really hit me right away. Like, it was something like kind of from the beyond, where I'm like, I get this guy on a level that I've never gotten anyone before. His comedy hit me pretty hard when I got it around the time I was about to go through puberty. And so Steve Martin Brothers, Let's Get Small.
Yeah, Let's Get Small. Yep.
And Comedy's Not Pretty.
Yeah.
Are like some of the greatest comedy albums ever done. And I kind of wish that he just kept going.
Yeah.
But he kind of explains it, I think, in that book that he published, that autobiography on, what was it called?
I think I need to read that because I don't know that one, but it sounds like I just added a book to my list.
It's about 3 years old now.
Okay.
And he takes you on his whole journey through being a stand-up comedian.
Right.
At the pinnacle of his game.
Yeah.
And then I think his reasons for dropping off.
Right.
And he ties it in with his relationships with his family.
Right.
So it's amazing to get from the source, like, you know, the whole King Tut thing or whatever.
He
lays it down
right
in the book. It's amazing. So I think it's called Standing Up.
Okay, Standing Up. I gotta look for that.
Something with the word stand up in it.
All those guys like Steve Martin, Robin Williams, Richard Pryor.
Totally.
You know, they were all coming up around the same time. I'm sure there's many others. I'm just off the top of my head. I can't think of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I think also, you know, the drugs kicked in at a certain point and, you know, had you know, alternately inspiring and damaging effects on everybody.
Yeah,
this is true in all art forms at that time.
Oh yeah, you listen to those like 70s records that Robin Williams made.
Yeah,
and he's so high on coke.
Yeah,
even as a kid listening to him, I'm like, normal people don't talk like
that. Yeah, yeah, something's going on here that isn't. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And it's funny. I met Robin Williams. I met him twice.
Oh really?
There's a lot of movies that are shot in Toronto. So, you know, every now and then there'll be movie star sighting and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was like in the dead of winter and I was walking somewhere downtown in the club district. I don't know where I was going. And I saw this guy just walking really slowly with a huge red parka on. And he had this hood on and he had two bags.
Uh-huh.
They looked like some kind of, if the parka wasn't a very expensive looking parka, he would have looked like this homeless guy with these like kind of plasticky bag looking things. And he's walking down the street. And the closer I got to him, I immediately knew it was Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And just because I'm in Toronto and I'm not in LA, because the movie, it's called Hollywood North, Toronto is.
Yeah.
So I knew that that looks like, oh no, that's Robin Williams. We're in Toronto.
Yeah, yeah.
And I walk by and I said, I'm a big fan. That's all I said to him. I didn't call him out. He just nodded. He just nodded silently and kept walking.
Yeah.
And then I realized that there was this thing on his album at the end of the Throbbing Python of Love, where there's this kind of little scene that he plays out when he actually meets someone who knows him, and he's the thing. So the second time I met him, he was doing, I guess he was in town again with a movie, but he went to an open night, like an open mic night.
Yeah.
And he was on stage. They just gave, you know, he just walks in, and it was right. The back of this restaurant that had an open mic night.
Wow.
And one of our friends is a comedian. And he texted JC and he said, Robin Williams is here. And so we all just got in the car and we drove over to the club. And afterwards, you know, people were asking him for photographs and stuff.
Sure.
And yeah. So I went up to him. I'm like, now I'm prepared. I know exactly what to say to him.
Yeah.
And we went for a photo. And right before the guy clicked the photo, I go, I've always wanted to say this to you. If I met you once, I always wanted to say, joke them if they can't take a fuck. And then I just posed for the photo, and the photograph is him like looking at me, and he goes, that's a wonderful tribute, thank you, because that was the last
from
line,
the line of that
throb- yeah. Yeah, so yeah. I got it in, you know. I've, yeah. It always bugged me when I met him that first yeah. time. I was like, fuck, I should have said that to him. And then when I yeah. saw him, I was like, all right, joke him if you can't take a fuck. And, yeah. and that was it. So that's my Robin Williams story. But I have the photo, and he's looking at me. He's not looking at the camera, and it's the yeah. best moment ever. It's really nice, and he's smiling and everything, and he's like looking at me. So I'm looking at the camera because I said what I had to say, and I'm just
the only comedian, and he's a great one, that I ever met was Don Knotts.
Oh, the original, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The original Mr. Furley and from Three's Company.
And that's how we got on the whole yeah. Three's Company.
Yeah, I was on tour with the Screaming Trees, and we were playing in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he was staying in the same hotel that we were, and he was with Barbara Eden, who is, you know, I Dream of Jeannie, you know,
right.
who's like the hottest babe on television
exactly.
when you're 10,
yeah.
you know.
And still today,
oh, yeah,
I've done Google image searches.
Yeah. We've all Googled yeah. I Dream of Jeannie, but he and her were doing a traveling version of Last of the Red Hot Lovers, a Neil Simon play.
Wow!
And they were staying in our hotel. And
what year is this?
This is about 90, I'm gonna say 93, 94. So I mean 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and one of my crew guys and I were standing in the lobby of the hotel, and the elevator door opens, and it's Don Knotts. And so we just, I mean, it's a shocking thing when you see somebody that you grew up with, yeah. you know, as like a icon on television and
yeah.
everything. And you're not expecting it in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Right.
And my drum tech got his picture taken with him. I didn't, but, you know, this is before the age of digital cameras, the internet and cell phones, you know, it's like hard camera film, you know. And I was never much for
Well, then how did he have a camera on him?
You know, he actually was one of those guys that had the foresight to have a camera with him almost at all times. I have met lots of people and been in great situations, and I just never think to take a photo because I just want to experience that moment
yeah, right.
with that person. Yeah. I don't need to photograph it. But
now,
boy,
today,
now,
those moments are being disrupted because of that.
Yeah, every well, you know, it's kind of part of being a rock and roller. You know, you meet a lot of people, shake a lot of hands, sign CDs, and get your picture taken, you know,
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
And so you just, you know, it's you adapt to the changing times that you're in.
Yeah.
So, but I'd like to think that I perhaps am the Don Knotts to somebody else,
yeah.
as he was to me.
Right.
So.
So he walks out of the elevator?
Yeah, he just walked out of the elevator, and it was my drum tech who noticed him first, and
right.
and he said, "Oh, Mr. Knotts," you know, something like that. Like, you know, we were always very respectful.
Of course.
I've always said Mr. to everybody I ever met, you know.
Right.
I even refer to you as Mr. Jones,
because
I think that sounds good.
Well, thank you, Mr. Martin.
But anyway, he was very polite. You know, wonderful guy. You know, I mean, Don Knotts and people of that era, that's old Hollywood, you know.
Oh, yeah,
it's like
yeah,
classic,
totally, yeah.
classic, classy people, great actors.
Yeah.
Very different from what Hollywood passes off today.
Yes.
As an actor.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, yeah. Anyway, I've had a few moments like that where I met people. That,
did Barbara Eden come out?
No,
after?
She wasn't. I think she was already, you know, down at the theater at the local playhouse or whatever. I didn't get to meet her. The only other person that I've met in my life that really, you know, I was pretty amazed when I met him was Fidel Castro. And that's an entirely different story, but I just had to like get this in there because
yes,
you meet a lot of people in your life and you meet, you know, actors and other musicians that you admire their work and you have something that, you know, you can talk about, you know, like you and I talk about records that we like, or mm-hmm. we talk about, you know, TV shows, right. things like that. But I was in Cuba in 1999 for this. It was a music diplomacy program that President Clinton set up. So it was a legitimate, you know, we traveled.
That was my next question. Yeah,
we flew down there as a group of musicians.
Screaming Trees?
No, not it wasn't by band. It was more like you were selected by artists. So some of the people on the plane were Burt Bacharach, Bonnie Raitt, the Indigo Girls, Michael Franti, myself, Peter Buck from REM.
Oh, so it was that project.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they didn't send entire bands. They would just send people, individuals that, like, we had to be interviewed, and they wanted people that had good diplomatic conversational skills, you know, and,
yeah.
you know, maybe a little bit of a, you know, Spanish language, you know, ability, which
right.
I can kind of understand and barely speak Spanish, but enough that I could get by in Cuba.
And
know?
Bert does, I guess.
I don't know. Bert probably could afford to have an interpreter with
yeah,
him,
right,
you know.
Right.
It was a really, you know, and people from Europe as well, like Patty Maloney from the Chieftains, Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland from the Police.
And you were all in this plane?
We're all on one jet that flew from Miami down to Havana. And we spent a couple weeks down there working with Cuban musicians, writing songs and recording them as a project. It was a exchange program.
It's amazing.
The Baltimore Orioles baseball team also came down and played the Cuban national team.
That's so random.
So, well, but, it, you know, there were one of the things that I think is important about being an artist is that, you know, it's the artists that go in and break the ice and start to create dialogue with the people. And if you, you know anything about Dizzy Gillespie, the great American trumpet player, mm-hmm. you know, he did that with his United Nations band, where he went around the world and played every capital of almost every major country in the world and took music to people. And, you know, there was an ambassadorial kind of thing going on with that. And the U.S. State Department still has a program like that, which I think it's mostly for jazz groups that they do that. They send them around the world. But in this case, they sent down rock musicians and singer-songwriters, and we worked with these Cuban musicians. And the last day before we left, we were summoned to the presidential, the palace or whatever they call it. And we just went through a diplomatic receiving line,
yeah.
you know, where you just shake
sure.
hands. And we met several dignitaries, and Fidel Castro was the big one.
Right.
And he was in a suit, three-piece suit. He's very well dressed.
Oh,
and now keeping in mind that I had done a lot of reading about, I've read all of Che Guevara's books, the you know Argentinian, but transplanted to Cuba,
right.
revolutionary. And the Cuban Revolution itself was a great thing. They kicked out the American mafia, which had been, you know, ruling Cuba, and turned it into a playground for the elite. So the Cuban Revolution kicked out those people. And gave it back to the people, and then it went, and then it became a dictatorship. So, this is often the case with revolutions. They start with great ideas and great intentions, and they turn into dictatorships.
Mm-hmm.
But that all being said, I was there representing the United States as a musician, and I met Mr. Castro, and I said, Cuba is a magnificent country with certainly some of the best musicians in the world. Really, and that is true. The Cuban musicians are amazing how good they are. And then I said, and now I've shaken the hand that fought beside Che Guevara. And he laughed and winked at me, and because it's a respectful.
Yeah,
you know,
I wasn't being
insulting in any way. I was honoring, you know, the original Cuban Revolution. So that's the only time I met somebody that I realized I was meeting a historical world figure here.
Yeah,
this is not just like a movie star or a this is like an iconic person. And he did have that,
of course,
that gravitas thing of, you know, somebody that stood up to the United States. So, and I'm not defending Fidel Castro as a dictator, but I'm honoring the Cuban Revolution and the fact that, you know, they booted the mafia mm-hmm. out of there and took their country back.
Right. Wow.
So, and I am one of those people that I'm against the Cuban embargo. There's no reason. I believe the statistic is that, you know, 99% of the people living in Cuba today were not even alive when the Cuban Missile right. Crisis happened, you know, so.
Well, being Canadian, I mean.
Right.
JC goes to.
You can go down there. Yeah.
Yeah. JC's been there. I think that's one of his favorite spots to vacation. Right?
He's oh,
been there
yeah.
a couple times. Yeah.
And if you want to learn about music and really see the top players in the world, Cuba and Brazil, those are the two places that I've been where I was stunned right. at the level of musicianship.
Yeah. I think he always has a great time. He always ends up hanging out with, I don't know, he does his own, he goes out and journeys and searches and finds, you know. And I'm more of an endorsement. Let's put it that way.
Endorsement? Oh, endorsement. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's more of an outdoorsman and I'm more of an endorsement. But whenever he comes back from Cuba, he's always got these stories and these people he's met and he loves the place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely. It's too bad. Well, we'll see how long
it
lasts.
I'm hopeful. I hope that at some point, you know, some intelligence will resume to the American political system and we'll get that embargo. That doesn't help anybody,
no,
you know.
It doesn't.
The world is evolved and advanced by exchange and communication and art and ideas and humanity. And you can't have that if you shut people off or shut off countries. Because when you do that, you create an isolated situation where very bad things can develop. Yeah. In a nutshell, that's what...
I want to end on that. That's a great...
Yeah, sure.
That's...
You and I could probably talk for... Every time we talk, we're going to have a different conversation.
Well, yeah.
This just happens to be the one we got today.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think we could... I think I might actually take you up on that and just quietly... do another podcast with you without you knowing and just record while in between chews at catering just crunching.
Just bring it you don't have to even secretly do it, just bring a tape machine, we'll just like sit there and eat and talk.
We should do that.